Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, Episode 42, The Battle of Brooklyn, Part 2. Yes, I left the episode number the same because, I broke these the two episodes into two pieces because the Battle of Brooklyn is definitely the largest battle, at least by number-wise, we will see throughout the entire Revolution. So I thought that since I was really getting close to a half hour talking the last episode, that instead of going on for an hour and 15 minutes or even worse, cutting out things that I felt were important just to keep my episode a little shorter was going to do it a disservice. So here we are with part two, and I know it's only been a short break, but I know you guys are ready to get into it. So when last we left off, Sterling, Parsons, and Attlee were holding their own against Grant and von Heister on the American right wing. Now, everyone still thinks that Grant's force is the lead elements of this main army. Howe has done a fantastic job of disguising his 20,000 troops that he has on Long Island from the prying eyes of the American spies, scouts, and riflemen. So they don't have any clue that Clinton is making this end run. And the only people that did know that Clinton was making this move were the five horseback officers that the British captured. So by 8:30 a.m. on August 27th, Howe and Clinton arrive at the town of Bedford. As planned, they fire two cannon shots to signal Grant and von Heister that they're in position. Colonel Samuel Miles, who had his riflemen set up in that area, is alerted to Howe and Clinton's presence at about 7 a.m. or so. Miles will move his 500 men to meet this new threat. There's a slight problem, though. Miles' men were moving through the woods. They're riflemen, they're backwoodsmen, they move much quicker through the woods than they would on the road. Plus, they conceal their position so that they can post up and hide so that when the British do show up, they can attack them from protected positions. Great plan. Only problem was, Howe and Clinton's men were moving rather quickly along the Jamaica Road. The two forces pass right by him, don't even realize it. When Miles does catch up to the British, or at least he thinks he does, he's run headfirst right into the rear of the column. Well, Miles is in a real predicament. He orders his men to retreat. About half will get away, but the other half are captured, Miles included. Seeing Miles' men race from the battlefield causes a mass exodus along the American center. Hundreds and thousands of troops are going to race for the protected position of Brooklyn Heights. So by 11 a.m., Cornwallis had chased the Americans back to the fortified position on the peninsula. The only force that was still in the field was Sterling's men on the American right. Cornwallis began to close in around him. The hope was that they could trap Sterling and capture that portion of the American right. But Howe kept the rest of his men outside the American fortifications. They were poised ready to attack. And many believe that if Howe did attack at this moment, he could have easily overtaken the position. The Americans were in retreat. They were in survival mode. Their energy was up, and they weren't ready for an all-out attack. So why doesn't he? Well, the first thought is a common theme when we're talking about General Howe during the American Revolution, and that's Bunker Hill. In his head, well, yeah, I could take the Heights. I was able to take Bunker Hill. But at what cost would assaulting this line of redoubts and forts do to my army? Yeah, 9,000 men are on the other side of this line. But what are those 9,000 going to do to my 20,000? He could easily be in a position where he could have a repeat of Bunker Hill. There's also the next obvious thing, exhaustion. His men had just spent the entire night marching. Then they went into close combat with the Americans. They must have been tired. So Howe places men out of the range of the rebel guns, and he was preparing to lay a traditional siege. Sterling's men, on the other hand, had been in their position from about 7 a.m. till about 11 a.m., and he and Grant were facing off with von Heister moving on his left. But by this point, like I had said, Cornwallis had chased the Americans back to the fortified line and was now closing in on Sterling. Sterling had to make a choice. He knew that something was going on in the American center. So he had to make this split-second decision. and he orders his men to race across the Gowanus Creek. He attempts to move through the woods, but runs headfirst into Cornwallis. The only option they have is to run across Gowanus Creek, and the tide was coming up. So the Gowanus Creek is a tidal creek. As the incoming tide comes in, the creek fills up with water. As the tide goes out, it actually turns into a marshland. So he has to make a choice. The tide is coming in. If he can get his men across before the tide is fully in, they can be on the other side of safety, and the British will be stuck on the other side of the creek. But if he waits too long, his men could be drowned with the incoming tide. So Stirling orders his men across, and he takes one regiment to give his men some time. This is where Washington's Immortals will get their name. Stirling, with the 1st Maryland, will, from the woods, charge Cornwallis repeatedly, each time falling back. This signal act of bravery saved almost the whole right wing. On the opposite side of the Gowanus Creek, a 15-year-old Joseph Plum Martin watches on as Stirling and the 1st Maryland charge Cornwallis's line. He watches men scrambled across the creek. Some men were able to swim to safety, others will drown. But a good portion of Stirling's 2,000 men will make it safely because the 1st Maryland and Stirling's leadership saved them so they could fight another day. Now, Joseph Plum Martin is a person that I'm going to refer to often. When we're talking about the Battle of Brooklyn, we are in 1776. And when we get to 1781 and we start talking about Yorktown, that's 5 years from now. He will be a young man of 20. Joseph Plum Martin, throughout the entirety of the American Revolution, is writing everything down that he sees. He is the best aide that historians of the American Revolution have, because he watched and he saw everything. And everything that he saw, he wrote down. He was a part of all the major campaigns with Washington. He was at Valley Forge. He's at Morristown. This is our best eyes into what life was like in Washington's camp and Washington's army until Yorktown. So Joseph Plum Martin is a name that you need to commit to memory, because he's one, as a source at least, I will refer to often. So with his men across the creek, Stirling orders the 1st Maryland to scatter. He's going to try and save as many as he can. Unfortunately, most of them are going to be captured. Stirling himself, who was not the thinnest of fellows and the most sprightly, knows that he has no chance of trying to escape. So the ever character that he is makes a fantastic move. He walks up to von Heister's men, the Hessians, and surrenders right to them. Stirling did not want to be captured by Grant. Grant was a man that criticized him in the House of Parliament a year earlier. Him and Grant have been going back and forth for some time. They were political rivals. This was the last time, well, at least in Stirling's mind, this would be the last good time that he had to thumb his nose at his competitor. So he surrenders to von Heister. With Stirling's men in retreat, Parsons and Attlee have no choice because they're going to be overrun themselves. So they order their men to retreat as well. They tell them to scatter, try and save yourselves, get to safety as best as you can. Once again, it's one of those situations that some will get there, but most of them are going to be captured. Attlee is captured himself, but Parsons will hide in a swamp until it's about a half dozen or so of his men, and will avoid capture and make it back to Brooklyn Heights. So with Stirling's men across the creek, Stirling captured, Attlee captured, the Battle of Brooklyn is officially over. This was a stunning victory for the British. They have 61 killed, 257 wounded, 31 captured. The Hessians, who were never counted with British numbers, had 2 killed, 26 wounded. Washington, a devastating defeat. 900 men were captured, 200 are killed or wounded. Of the 900 that are captured, 3 of these are generals, including names like Sullivan and Stirling, along with 90 other officers. Howe has scored a major victory. But one can't help to think, if he presses the attack What could happen? What would have happened? He stopped at 8:30 to fire those signal guns, which alerted the American center to a presence of British in the area. So if he didn't do that, could he have just rolled up on the American center and captured more troops? Could he have gotten Washington to surrender in the first major battle of the war? One of these things that we kind of say, well, this is a lot of what-if history. Washington is devastated by this loss. But he knows that he still has an army that he has to command and men that he has to tend to. He rides up and down the lines, giving his men encouragement, telling them that it's not over yet. He places grenadiers at regular intervals, haversacks full of grenades, prepared for the inevitable British attack. Though when on the night of the 27th they pitch their tents, it becomes very apparent that no attack would come tonight. This is something very unique about the battle. On the 28th, Howe could have pressed the attack. There was some rain, and the weather wasn't fantastic, but he could have pressed the attack. He had the numbers, he had Washington on his heels. But instead, he used this day as a day of preparation. Now, Washington continued to bring reinforcements over, preparing for what he figured was going to be a British attack at any moment that day. But Howe used the 28th to prepare for a siege. He was going to use a traditional siege to finish off Washington. So Howe sets his engineers to work preparing for the siege by planning out trenches. And through the night of the 28th, the British sappers dug 300 yards of trench parallel to the American lines. The work would continue into the following day, inching ever closer. So the way trench warfare works in the 18th century is you're not, it's not like World War I where you stand at opposite ends of a field and shoot at each other repeatedly. It was a little bit more strategic and mathematical. You built your trenches, and you would be at quite a distance from the position that you're trying to lay siege to. Then you would build a diagonal trench that would move you forward. And then you built a new trench line. Once again, that trench line would protect you. Then when that trench line was done, you built another diagonal. And you continue this work until you got your men and trenches close enough to a position so that you could use your artillery and muskets to attack the position. So that's what Howe is trying to do. And he's going to take time. But within 24 hours, he would be within musket range. Washington's staff was adamant that this would be the best chance they have to escape. General William Heath was convinced that the British are going to come up the river and move against Kingsbridge to assist with trapping the colonists on Long Island. And if they do so, the war is over. Washington, always willing to listen to his staff officers, decides that the evacuation must commence. And at 7 p.m. that night, the Massachusetts Mariners would head down to the ferry landing to assist with the incoming boats. General Thomas Mifflin was preparing a rear guard with Pennsylvania Continentals. Like the Marylanders, they were some of the best Continental soldiers that Washington had to offer, and he would need them to protect the American lines if Howe attacked that night. General Alexander McDougall, a ship captain from Massachusetts, commanded the embarkation. The evacuation would start around 8 p.m., and the first hour went really well. But as luck would have it, the wind would change, and it started to blow the boats very close to the entrance of the river and right into the British Navy. Well, the one good thing was that the wind kept the British Navy off the river, so they weren't coming up. But now with the slow pace of the evacuation, McDougall is worried that by sunrise, half the army could be on the wrong side of the river. He asks Washington to stop the evacuation. Washington denies the request. It's probably a good thing, because by 11 p.m., the wind changed again, and the evacuation would continue with 100% efficiency. The Continentals were even able to use sailing boats, which made things move much faster. Admiral Howe would not take advantage of this opportunity to go upriver. He has no idea that the Americans are escaping right underneath his noses. If he brings his ship upriver towards King's Bridge, he would have caught Washington and most of the army in the middle of the river and could have possibly ended the war right then and there. So for the next few hours, the evacuations continue without incident. That is until about 2 a.m., when the nighttime silence is broken by a cannon being fired. The American camp froze. No one knew where it came from. And it's one of these mysteries, because as suddenly as it came, the silence resumed. There was no more cannon fire. So no one knows where this mysterious cannon was fired from. But it put the Americans on edge. Mifflin, holding the front line, is the only thing protecting the Americans. Unfortunately, at some point, at about 3 a.m., Mifflin gets orders that he has to head to the ferry. So he takes his Continentals and heads to the ferry. Washington sees Mifflin's arrival and says, "My God, man, you have ruined us all." Mifflin, about faces, heads right back to his position on the front line. The British didn't have a clue. They did get a little skeptical about 4 a.m. At about 4 a.m., they started to notice there's no American pickets. Where are the American pickets? It's a head-scratcher, but once again, they didn't do anything about it. At least send a scout to investigate, and if they would have, they would have found out that most of the American lines were empty. And about sunrise, Mifflin finally gets his orders to head to the ferries. Now, growing up on Long Island, I know that in August, we get these rather cool nights, but these super hot days, and the next day was a scorcher. But it left a nice fog right on the river. This fog was the last bit of protection that could be offered to Washington. And by 7:30 a.m., the last of his boats had left the ferry, making their way back to Manhattan. And this ends the Battle of Brooklyn. The battle for New York is still to be decided, and in the coming weeks we're going to continue talking about several more battles that will happen in and around Manhattan and kind of solidify who controls New York for the rest of the war. But being that this was one of the largest battles of the American Revolution, I thought it would be interesting just to kind of review and reflect on the poor decisions that were made. This battle was so sloppily executed, it is unbelievable on both sides. Washington, not effectively scouting his enemy, inaccuracies in the scouting information, not double-checking their information. When it came to discipline in the ranks, he relied heavily on militia. He should have brought the cavalry over. All of these things were things that we talked about in both episodes about what was Washington thinking. The one good thing was when he knew that he was beat, he took his men and retreated. This would save America. General Howe definitely had a hand in saving America, I'll say. Him and Clinton can't get along. His second in command cannot get along. So the Battle of Brooklyn, I feel, was sloppily executed because Clinton started executing the plan without fully going over it with Howe. Howe had all the opportunities in the world to wipe the Americans right off of Long Island and chooses to play it safe and cautious. Not that I'm opposed to playing it cautious when you're facing an enemy that you believe is your superior and you need to find any way to beat them. Howe had the numbers, the manpower, the discipline, the technology, the supplies, the firepower, he had it all. He had everything over Washington. He misjudged the man, and he misjudged the conviction of the Americans. And by thinking that they were going to stay while he was going to lay siege was a clear oversight in the survival instincts of the Continental Army. So these are all just some interesting points that, you know, I just wanted to bring up. And just, you know, a little food for thought when you're thinking about these things. It's unfortunate that the battlefields in Brooklyn now are intersections and tenement buildings and restaurants, and they're, you know, they've lost their intrinsic value because they've been paved over. But I hope I did a decent job in kind of laying out as best I can the geographical view of what you would sort of, the best way I can figure to explain what you would be looking at. It's very difficult if you don't have a map in front of you, you have to be looking at at least a map of the battle itself to kind of understand who's moving where, and I get it. It's really hard for people to visualize. So I try to paint my word picture in other ways. So I hope that I did a good job in this first very major campaign. I know we were hopping a lot between the right and the left, and when we get to other campaigns later in the war, it gets even more complicated because we have one army doing this while another army is doing this, and then here's the British, and then so much is going on. But with that, I hope everyone will have a great week. I will be taking hopefully my snow day tomorrow and working on getting us ready for Kips Bay, the next major engagement when talking about the Battle of New York City. Till then, everyone remember, keep that powder dry.